One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. In fact, a few of you have got in touch recently to say that as a result of listening to the podcast, you're now listening to the radio. So, welcome aboard. Right, coming up on today's episode then, haven't they learned our lesson? Referendums are spreading around the world. Everyone seems to be having them, having them in Australia, there's talk about having them in France, they're even having one in Blackpool. Are they a good idea? Or was Margaret Thatcher right to say they were basically the work of dictators? That's coming up in our big thing in a moment. But first, when is the right time to judge whether or not something has been a success? There's only two people to ask.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
Yeah, and as it's Tuesday, we say hello to Times columnist Danny Finkelstein. Hello, Danny.
Hello.
And Deputy Opinion Editor and Columnist at the FT, Miranda Green. Hello, Miranda.
Hello, Matt. Hello, Danny.
Nice to have you both back with us on a Tuesday. Now, here's a sort of a big picture question I want to try and to wrangle with. How long do we have to wait before we can judge failure or success? So there's been sort of lots of data out in the last couple of weeks. There was the economic data, which looked at the ONS upgraded how the economy had done since the pandemic. Turned out that far from being one of the worst countries, we're actually one of the best in terms of recovering, with the economy now bigger than it was pre-pandemic. Similarly, in terms of excess deaths and so on, actually things weren't as bad as, you know, quite mid-table, has to be said. Quite a long way, Miranda, from when the New York Times dubbed the UK Plague Island. So how long should we wait, Miranda, before judging these things?
Well, we don't want to be in the kind of Chairman Mao situation, do we, of saying it's too early to tell whether the French Revolution was a success or not, because you need the right data to make the right policies. So that's the problem with these early estimates of how well the economy is doing, excuse me, frog in my throat, that then have to be revised in such a dramatic way, either one way or the other, because it happens in both directions sometimes. So I think the problem here is that, you know, if you've got businesses trying to make plans and Whitehall trying to make plans on how to, you know, form economic policy coming out of such an enormous crisis like the pandemic and the lockdowns, which were a problem for businesses, it turned out that the initial survey data, which businesses and other sorts of organizations had returned, was too pessimistic for what the picture eventually turned out to be, and significantly in two big sectors, one the wholesale sector and the other healthcare. And of course, there was this huge, enormous growth in the activity of the healthcare sector because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And that wasn't showing up in the initial survey returns. So the ONS, you know, has had to say, well, actually, we're not an outlier in terms of recovering from the pandemic experience in the economy. We're actually doing pretty well. And they've also had to say they'll look again at how they use these initial survey returns and whether it's actually becoming slightly misleading. I mean, we did have an inquiry about 7 years ago, I think it was, which a former senior member of the MPC actually looked at the use of economics data in the UK and whether there was a case for doing it slightly differently. So it'd be interesting to see what the statistics regulator says when it looks at this question. But, you know, we do need timely data on how the economy's doing, you know, not for reasons of setting a narrative, although obviously I'm sure that Danny will go on to explain why that's so important in politics, but also because it matters for devising the right economic policies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Danny, now I remember during the depths of the pandemic when you were coming on, actually you got quite a bit of grief from some listeners when you said we need to wait and see. You weren't sure that actually we would turn out to be a world leader in awfulness.
Yeah, I did. And I thought it was actually, I think this, the fact that we finished in the middle of the pack, which isn't actually an exceptional performance. There's lots of reason to think, you know, maybe we could have done better than that on excess mortality. I thought it was blindingly obvious, and that was a highly likely outcome. And I couldn't believe how much how controversial it was to say that. People were extremely fixed on trying to argue that we had the worst death toll in the world. As if that was some, you know, as if only they could prove that, it would kind of make some sort of progress. I feel it's something that everybody needs to reflect on for a couple of reasons. One set is what Miranda said, but the second is for people like me who were sceptical, you know, or antagonistic to Boris Johnson, who voted to remain in the referendum, who are concerned about some trends on the right in various different ways. We've got to retain our own sense of perspective, our respect for the truth, our ability to see things in proportion, our willingness to wait for facts to unfold. And I feel that sometimes those things are lacking, and I'm afraid it was lacking in this case. And, you know, to take extreme positions based on small amounts of data for essentially propagandist reasons and persuade oneself massively that it must be true because you dislike Boris Johnson is exactly the politics that the centre is designed to try to reject. So I was pretty distressed by it because I thought at the time it was just, you remember, for example, Matt, there was a lot of reporting about how Dominic Cummings was deliberately trying to kill old people for something related to, you know, the Tory vote. Didn't even make sense in its own terms. There were a lot of reporting about the things that he did or didn't say. And that all turned out to be completely wrong. I mean, it wasn't what his position was even, right? And so we've really got to learn from this, particularly people who are coming from my broad position, because if we do not, if we're not people who stress sense of proportion, who stress facts, who wait patiently for things to unfold, who reject narratives just because they're convenient and support the things that we say, then who is going to do that in politics?
It's interesting that point you make, Danny, is that if your starting point is do I like the person rather than is what they're doing working, and actually that you know cuts across, but that cuts across politics, doesn't it? In the way that, you know, when you come to vote, if it's all about personality and not about competence and record,
I don't think it was just about that. I think people could sense, which was unquestionably true, that Boris Johnson, even at that point, that Boris Johnson's premiership was chaotic, that some of the relationships were dysfunctional. It was clear, as Dominic Cummings, I think, has argued, that there were also some problems with the machine. There were lots of different reasons to believe that government was not organised in an optimal way to achieve the best outcomes. And I think it didn't achieve the best outcomes. But what was not true was that it was among the worst in Europe. And one thing that I would say is, if you finish in the middle of the pack, it's quite possible that the outcomes were random. In other words, they didn't reflect anything that we did. That's only one explanation of that position, right? It's not the only explanation. But I'm just urging a nuanced view, even when the facts are a bit inconvenient, because people would, I think, have liked it to be the case that Boris Johnson's chaos led directly to sort of observably much worse outcomes than other countries achieved, because it would kind of reinforce arguments. But to my mind, the only thing that should matter to people who are trying to make the country make sort of gentle, moderate, but sensible progress is whether it's a fact or not. And I think people, you know, it was so logical that if we, that people would make all sorts of different mistakes in different countries, and some of those would average out against each other, and that if you went early with lockdowns, you would have some problems that would pop up later, and if you didn't go early, you would have this exponential growth at the beginning. It was so obvious that it was difficult to get exactly the right solution on the all the time, consistently through it. And yet this didn't seem to be accepted. And I understand why that was the case. Yeah. I can see it and empathise with it in some ways, but it's to be avoided.
I suppose there is just a little wrinkle in that, though, isn't there? Which is that we're not going to know for a while what some of the trade-offs were in terms of the facts from the lockdowns and from the fact that the NHS just had to sort of ditch a whole bunch of other things that it was doing in order to concentrate on the COVID crisis and keep the wards safe from COVID. So you know, in the sense of, I totally agree with everything Danny said, but actually it's probably only in a few years' time that we will know the cost to people with other conditions of what happened in the NHS. So that's another thing that we'll have to factor into our assessments.
I suppose the thing that happened on the other side is that when you've got Boris Johnson boasting that we're world-beating, world-leading, global outliers in the positive, that sort of invites criticism to prove the opposite. That actually
it's infuriating. I agree. And I think some people were pushed by that infuriating nonsense to themselves then engage in probably slightly less nonsensical, but nevertheless incorrect analysis. And I just think that ought to be avoided. By the way, while we're on this subject of different narratives that are undermined by figures, obviously one of the things that this data questions is whether or not those people who were talking about the immense economic cost of COVID being worth the death reduction are relying upon what turns out to be false figures about how big the impact on the economy
was.
That's
interesting, So the sort of people who said, well, actually, we should have let more people die because it would have saved the economy, essentially. If the economy wasn't as badly hit as we thought,
it may be because this was part of the argument. It may be that the decision to lock down the economy was better for the economy in the longer run than it would have been to let the disease run riot with the impact that would have had on the economy. So even on the economy, this argument may turn out to be incorrect. But these figures challenge everyone's narrative. I concentrated on the bit that sort of challenged the narrative of people like me. In other words, people who were sceptical or dismayed by the way that Boris Johnson organised his government and were therefore ready to believe that the result of that was automatically a disastrous performance. But sometimes maybe didn't, you know, allow for the fact that the response to the pandemic wasn't just Boris Johnson, it was also Chris Whitty's and Patrick Vallance. And all the way along, I was thinking to myself, how likely is it that those incredibly capable people are achieving, you know, demonstrably worse outcomes? But it didn't seem that it was true. It seems true that their advice was being routinely rejected by Boris Johnson. So I think this is an important correction, which is vital to understand on other issues, not just this one.
And actually, the best reaction to the correction and the revised figures is for us to think, well, what did we get wrong? Rather than going, told you so, and then engaging in the same row just from the opposite end of the telescope. Right, up next.
Can I just say, I think I found the record-breaking sort of GDP growth error, by the way, which my colleague John Byrne Murdoch found at the end of last week, which is that in Ireland in 2015, they thought GDP growth was 1.4%, and it turned out afterwards that it was 21.4% because a whole bunch of tech companies and pharma companies flooding into Dublin. So, you know, we're not the only country that also gets these initial figures really wrong, you know. Well, yeah, we tend to be more pessimistic, though, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And yeah, that's the other thing. We're really bad at noticing things happening in other countries. Whether it's, you know, Germany's about to go into recession. Is that all over the front pages? No. Whereas, you know, if Britain was about to... I mean, I suppose that is to do with geography, but yeah, it's a reminder that we ignore the things which are happening in other parts of the world. Now, here's a question. Does it matter that Keir Starmer is being outpolled by the Labour Party? So, in the latest YouGov polling, Keir Starmer's got a negative approval rating of minus 20, whereas Labour's approval rating is minus 11. Flip side is Rishi Sunak is polling better than the Tories. He's on minus 41, while the Conservative Party overall is on minus 48. Is this a problem, Miranda? Is it a sign that actually, come the election, Keir Starmer might be a bit of a drag on the number of people who will switch to Labour?
Drag, I think, might be overstating it, but the leader and whether people actually feel so much attracted, but that they can trust that leader and that they're going to take the country in the right direction is a key ingredient in voting choice. And, you know, ipsos mori, you know, always talk about the things that really matter to people. And the leader is always one of the top three things that they're thinking about. I would say that compared to the Sunak and the Conservative ratings in that polling, you know, he's still in a much, much better place than Sunak, even though Sunak is out polling his own party. Yeah, of course, Sunak is really recently in the job. You know, it's only coming up to a year, right? So, you know, Starmer's had to battle the left. He's had a really complicated job to do since becoming Labour Party leader. And it's possible that some of the things that come out in the focus groups are affecting those ratings for him. For example, you know, he had to promise the left all sorts of things in order to win the leadership. And he's now ruthlessly kind of excised them from the party and made them, including his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn, ex-Labour people. You know, so he's had to go through the mill in a really quite short time span since becoming leader. And that may make people a little bit unsure of where he himself personally stands and where his kind of political heart beats. And I think that's a problem for him, particularly if you sort of compare him to Tony Blair, because you knew that Tony Blair's heart was beating in time with the British public. Starmer probably doesn't. He probably has to think about it first before he makes an utterance on something. I think that's probably all feeding into it.
Yeah, people can sort of slightly sense that as well. Well, talking of the Tony Blair tribute act, I don't know if you've seen this, Danny. They've released the conference brochure for the Labour Party conference. We've got a very moody photo of Keir Starmer on the front cover, which lots of people have pointed out looks quite a lot like the 1997 New Labour Manifesto, which had a rather moody photo of Tony Blair on it. Although we were talking in the office earlier, and Kate McCann pointed out the big difference is that Tony Blair's looking directly at you, whereas Keir Starmer's looking off to the left. Read into that what you will.
Obviously, they're trying to promote Keir Starmer because he's got the weaker of the two figures. I was trying to think, look, obviously one of these figures is likely to be ahead of the other. That's just maths. So which would you pick if you were Keir Starmer? Would you rather be ahead of your party or your party ahead of you? So I think it's quite an achievement for Keir Starmer that the party is ahead of him, because after all, the problem he had was that Labour's brand was in difficulty.
Yeah.
That's actually the main job he's settled for himself. So I wonder whether he wouldn't be quite satisfied. You know, my general principle in answering these questions, which you often get, which is, you know, is X or Y a problem for Keir Starmer? Nothing much of a problem for Keir Starmer at the moment. And we'll get any problems he has in proportion. He's doing incredibly well. The party's doing incredibly well. And it looks set fair to win the general election. So you in those circumstances, he has few problems. Clearly, lack of enthusiasm for him is one of the things that holds back Labour, and it may
be for him to alter that because of his, you know, I don't think he's the best public performer, despite the fact that I actually, you know, think highly of him as an intelligent person. I don't think he's the best public performer. He's managed to do to the Labour Party what what he'd want, which is to put it in a stronger brand position. It's not brilliantly strong. That's still a reasonable negative rating, but it's quite a lot stronger than it was, and it's much stronger than the Tories. So I'm not sure I think I'd probably pick that of the, you know, given you're going to have either the problem the party's ahead of him or he's ahead of the party. I think I'd probably prefer it if I were him, if the party was ahead of me.
It's a good point, that actually, isn't it, Miranda? Given how bad the Labour brand was in 2019 after the departure of Jeremy Corbyn.
Totally. And I mean, you know, the sort of voting intention polls now show a sort of consistent lead of about 20 points. in favour of the Labour Party, which, given where they were under Jeremy Corbyn, is absolutely phenomenal. But I do think it draws attention, and this is a bone that Danny and I pick over from time to time, it draws attention to Starmer's remaining tasks, right, in order to kind of seal the deal with the electorate, which are to try and give them a positive reason for choosing him, other than that he's not kind of chaos and incompetence and five prime ministers within no time at all, which is what the other party has given us. So, you know, I don't think Starmer's, you know, lack of oomph and charisma is too much of a problem. You know, a little bit less drama is probably what the country's crying out for, but he does need to set out some sort of positive stall. And I don't know if Danny's
so the problem is,
I'm being a sentimental idiot for saying that.
Go on, Danny.
I don't think you're being either of those things, but I think Keir Starmer, to improve his own rating, would need to seem kind of more enthusiastic and impassioned by the things that he's arguing for. And the problem is, I don't think he's that strongly in favour of his own policy. I think he can see the intellectual merit in the policy reassuring people, but his entire career and the things that have motivated him have been to being somewhat to the left of, you know, slightly to the left of Ed Miliband is where I'd put his politics on a consistent basis. He's never said anything massively interesting politically, but that is roughly speaking he's been. I've known of him since he was in his 20s, and that's where he's always been. And I just think if he probably was that impassioned, he might, you know, start moving the Labour Party to the left, thus reducing the Labour Party's brand.
Yeah. Yes.
Miranda Green from the FT and Danny Finkelstein from the Times. And of course, you can read Danny in the Times every Wednesday. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, do you want another referendum? Vote now.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
So many big issues around immigration, concrete in schools, net zero, China. Would anyone like a referendum on that?
For the referendum, is it all around?
Mr. Sanna, do you agree with David Cameron or not?
I was just going to make another point about
No, do you agree with David Cameron or not?
People of Scotland have spoken, and it is a clear result.
Putting to you, in a referendum, the choice to introduce a new voting system. The alternative vote.
And the alternative
Why?
Vote system, the alternative
Why
vote
it?
System.
It doesn't
because,
in Australia.
Because
the choice is in your hands.
Well, what I think You're people want games. Us to do is to leave the European Union on
well,
October 31st.
We all
31st.
Know that.
Ah, good times. Good times. Referendums are pretty rare throughout most of the 20th century. UK, we've only actually had three fully nationwide referendums. The one in 1975, the vote on staying in what then became the EU. 2016 vote on leaving, and a vote in 2011 on electoral reform. Who can forget that? When I was at the Independent on Sunday, we had a street party in favour of the alternative vote, and nobody came. There was obviously also the Scottish referendum in 2014, which we just heard from there as well. Overall, there have been around 600 referendums held worldwide since the 1970s. They exploded in popularity in the 1990s. Switzerland in particular love them. They had 11 referendums last year alone. But so why are they becoming more popular? Do they solve more problems they create? Is it a way of politicians abdicating responsibility to take big decisions in the national interest? So what we thought we'd do is get right around the world. It's been a long time since we fired up the plane. We couldn't afford the fuel, frankly. And there was all that trouble with the air traffic control. So it's all back on Chorley Airlines. Let's hop on the plane and find out. Yeah, put your seats in the upright position. We're off to France, first of all. David Chazan is a journalist for the Times in Paris. And joins us now. Hi, David.
Hi, Matt.
So you've got Emmanuel Macron struggling out a parliamentary majority. How could he use referendums to break that political deadlock in France?
Well, he's mooted the idea to the opposition of holding referendums because he's trying to drum up support from opposition parties, particularly from the centre-right, for new laws, tougher laws on immigration, which is a very hot topic here as it is in the UK. But so far, he's not having much success in reaching an agreement on that. And at the same time, the left is still agitating for a referendum on President Macron's pension reforms, even though the increase in the statutory retirement age has already gone through. So you've got demands from both the left and the right, and Macron toying with the idea of holding referendums as a way of breaking the parliamentary deadlock.
I mean, I suppose maybe the lesson for previous referendums is you only call them if you think that actually the public support your position. Is it where are the public on the question of like his pension reforms or on immigration? Would he emerge as the winner, if you like? Because you're not going to call a referendum if you're going to lose the argument.
Well, I think on immigration, the public overwhelmingly would back tougher laws because they're seeing an influx of people coming in. A lot of people are very, very worried about the future of France. Can the social services cope, etc., etc.? But certainly on pension reforms, it would be a disaster for Macron if a referendum were held because the majority of the public are still clearly opposed to his increase in the pension age, and that's been shown repeatedly in opinion polls.
And what would the, if there were to be, and I know the question has sort of been put from the right, if there was a referendum on migration, what's the question?
Well, that's the big issue, and that's what Macron's been trying to agree on with the centre-right. But the question would essentially be, do you want to make it more difficult for people to come into France? Do you want to toughen up citizenship laws? And what the right-wing parties are looking for is a way of stopping the children of immigrants from automatically being granted French citizenship if they're born in France. But that's anathema for the centrist group of President Macron.
Just finally, before I let you go, David, overall, the chances of the voters in France having any sort of referendum in the foreseeable future?
I think they're quite low, to be honest,
yeah.
Because I think that the French political elites looked at the Brexit referendum and they said, that is not a road we want to go down on. And they still remember a referendum held in France on a new constitution for the European Union, which was rejected by French voters, subsequently put through in a somewhat different form by the EU without a plebiscite or a referendum.
Oh, of course, yeah. But they got the wrong answer. They found a way around it anyway. David, really good speech to you. David Chazan there is a journalist for the Times in Paris. But it's back on the plane. And we're heading to Poland now. Paulina Olzanka is a journalist of the Times there. Hi, Paulina.
How about, how are you going?
Very good. So you have got a referendum in mid-October in Poland. What's been voted on?
Well, four key political questions: how Poles feel about the privatization of state assets, how they feel about immigration quotas, what they think the age of retirement should be, and whether they feel that the wall between Poland and Belarus that has been built to keep out migrants should be removed. However, it's being held on the same day as the parliamentary elections.
And so what impact will that have? And will it be binding on whoever wins those parliamentary elections?
It should be. If there is if 50% of voters turn out to vote in the referendum, yes, theoretically it should be binding. The issue here is that the referendum is largely understood to be deployed in a very cynical way, so as to actually sneak in questions in the polling booths that may actually sway voters to vote in a particular way in the parliamentary election. So the referendum here is actually not the most important thing, because you still need to get reach a 50% threshold for that referendum to be binding. Only about 35% of Poles say that they will actually vote in the referendum. However, if you're going to the voting booth on that day, you're reading questions that are extremely loaded in language, which I'm happy to read out in a moment. The assumption there is that it may actually affect the outcome of the elections, because it's bypassing the normal blackout laws that you have 24 hours before the election, so you're not allowed to campaign during those 24 hours. There's also, some commentators have said that this is also a way that Poland can use state money for campaigning purposes rather than party allocated funds.
It's really interesting. Your point is that it's less about whether or not the referendum question is passed, but if you've got, as you were saying, was it two questions, referendum questions, on essentially borders and immigration,
yep,
that just raises the salience of immigration when people are going in and voting in the parliamentary elections. Give us an example then of what you said was one of the loaded questions.
So, do you support the admission of thousands of illegal immigrants from the Middle East and Africa under the forced relocation policy imposed by European bureaucracy? So this is not a not leading question, but even the more prosaic questions, for example, around the nationalization or the privatization of state assets, is also loaded. So do you support the sale of state assets to foreign entities leading to the loss of control over strategic sectors of the economy?
Wow.
This is not even a matter within political discourse, but if you are somebody that is going to the elections, you read this question, of course it raises certain existential concerns.
That's absolutely fascinating. That's mid-October. We'll keep an eye on that. Really interesting. Pauline Olzanka, journalist from The Times, there joining us in Poland. But the plane's about to take off, so we need to head back to the airports. Yeah, we're off to Kazakhstan now. Well, apparently he's absolutely bucketing it down, so we need a right mixture of clothes to take for this. Joanna Lillis is in Astana for us. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm in Almaty, actually.
Oh, sorry, but I apologise. Tell us about the referendum which is happening in Kazakhstan.
So, in Kazakhstan, we're expecting a referendum on nuclear power. Now, this referendum was called by the president, or at least announced by the president earlier this month when he gave his State of the Nation address. And it's going to be quite contentious. Now, as I'm sure many listeners know, Kazakhstan's not a true democracy. Elections tend to be swung, tend to be rigged, tend to be always giving the outcomes that the authorities want. So it's actually quite interesting that President Kasym Jomart Tokayev has decided to hold a referendum on a topic, on a subject where many of the people in Kazakhstan are actually, you know, against nuclear power. And clearly what the government wants is a yes vote for nuclear power. The reason for that is that Kazakhstan suffers from chronic energy shortages, despite the fact that it's a major oil producer and also produces gas. I mean, there are many reasons for that we don't really have time to go into, I'm sure. But the fact is that the government needs a yes vote so that it can solve this energy crisis that Kazakhstan has suffered over several winters, which involves blackouts and, leads to a lot of public discontent. Now, I think the key question here is, why has the president of this authoritarian country decided to go to the people?
You read my mind. I was about to say that. If the elections are basically rigged and he can do what he likes anyway, what's the point of holding a referendum? Can't he just do what he wants on nuclear power?
Right. Well, that's the key question. I think that's something that's interesting many people in Kazakhstan. And I think to answer that question, we need to go back to last year. Last year, Kazakhstan witnessed some major, major protests, which began as a sort of peaceful protest over socio-economic discontent. And we can see how energy crisis can fit into that. And in those protests were peaceful in the beginning, hijacked by violent forces, turned violent, and ended with the deaths of over 200 people. To move on from that, the president said that in the future he was going to be a more listening kind of president. He was going to listen to the people. And he also promised that on important questions, he would go to the country and hold a referendum. Now, he's already held one referendum, and that was on a constitutional reform following those protests. But again, this was just kind of bulldozed through, really. But now we're talking about something completely different. Now, many people in Kazakhstan feel really, really strongly about nuclear power. They do in many countries, but let me explain why in Kazakhstan this is so very sensitive. For 40 years, from the 1940s, Kazakhstan was a nuclear testing ground for the Soviet Union, Moscow, the Kremlin, exploding hundreds of nuclear explosions on the steppes of Kazakhstan, leaving a devastating environmental and impact, and also impact on people's health. And there are still people in that part of Kazakhstan, in the east, the northeast, who suffer from the health consequences of that. People born deformed, people who, you know, get cancer very early in life. And so you can imagine how people feel about nuclear power in Kazakhstan. The government itself, over the last 30 years of independence, has constantly stressed the damage that nuclear explosions did to Kazakhstan. Now, of course, it's a different thing to have nuclear power, but nuclear power is a very sensitive topic. So I think what's interesting here is the government going to be able to secure the yes vote that it needs without resorting to rigging?
Yeah.
Is it going to be able to swing public opinion? Now, that's a big question. And if not, is that going to lead to, again, you know, the kind of protest that we saw last year?
It's absolutely fascinating, that. Really good to speak to you. That's Joanna Lillis joining us live from Kazakhstan. Well, our tour of the globe continues. We'll hop back on the plane just while we're waiting on the taxiing to the runway. In the chair in front of you, you'll see a pamphlet with a number of fantastic products being advertised. I'll be coming down the aisle over the next couple of minutes to take your order.
This is Times Radio.
Very good morning. It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio, heading off on Chorley Airlines, looking at referendums around the world. So let's hop back on the plane. Well, it was a long old flight, that one, 20 hours from Kazakhstan to Sydney, because Australia are holding a big, big referendum on the Indigenous Voice. It's taking place on October the 14th, where we can speak to Latika Burke from the Sydney Morning Herald. Hi, Latika.
Good day, Matt.
Right, take us through what this referendum is on and what will happen if it passes.
So the referendum will be held on October 14, and it essentially asks Australians to approve an Indigenous voice to Parliament. So this would be an advisory body comprised of Indigenous leaders who would then be able to tell the federal government what it believes should be policy on any policies that affect Indigenous Australians.
Why does that need a referendum? Why can't the Parliament or the government just create a body like that?
Well, we've had bodies in the past, and some of those have been disbanded because they've been ineffectual, or there's been issues of governance, or that they just simply have not worked. The main problem is what we call in Australia closing the gap, and this is the divide between life expectancy and outcomes for Indigenous Australians versus non-Indigenous Australians. And they are bad, and some of those measures are actually going backwards. So about 7 years ago, some leaders in the Indigenous community came together and formed a statement from the heart, they call it, and came up with this idea. Now, there are two separate concepts here. One is recognising Indigenous Australians in the federal constitution, saying that they were there first and what had happened to them and acknowledging that. The second component of that, but related in this same question, will be about approving the voice to Parliament. And that, of course, is the most contentious part.
So what is the argument against it, given, as you were saying, that the life chances of Indigenous people are less good? This is, I mean, it's an advisory body, it doesn't fundamentally change the powers of the Parliament. What's the argument against it?
Well, there's many arguments against it, actually, and this is one of the huge problems the Yes campaign is facing. Because, as you say, if it's an advisory body that doesn't have power over executive government, and the Prime Minister has been very, very careful to stress that it will not have any veto, then people say, well, what's the point? The Yes campaign would say, well, it would be a very brave government that would ignore the advice of the Indigenous community that's just been formed and acknowledged in the constitution to advise government. So then you say, well, is it acting as a quasi-veto then after all? So that's one of the first contradictions. There's a lot of concern within the Australian community that this is excessive, this goes over its remit. And Australians are very, very cautious by nature about changing the constitution. Currently, the polls have this down at 43% in favour, and that's a huge slump from the start of the year when there was a majority in favour. So as time has gone on and the date gets closer, Matt, and people take more of a considered look at this, it actually appears they're turning their backs on this proposition. But of course, we won't know for sure until October 14.
And I was reading that Australia's not had a successful referendum, which is voted yes to anything, in almost 50 years. Persevere with this thing if in the end Aussies just say no?
We have a very conservative electorate on the front of changing the constitution. One thing to keep in mind, we have a written constitution. So to change it, unlike the British, we have to ask for a majority of the voting public, but also a majority of the states. And that's a very, very high hurdle to cross. And in fact, back when the Yes campaign for the Indigenous Voice to Parliament was looking a bit stronger, there were even then some concerns that some of the no vote could be so strong in states like Queensland or Western Australia, they could actually depress the national votes so much that we could get a scenario where enough states approved it, but not enough of the population. Right now, that scenario is not even looking likely. It's looking more probable that it will be just no. But Australians don't like to change the constitution. You're absolutely right. The last one we had was about a republic, and that was also no. And no prime minister has gone back to the people with a proposed change to the constitution ever since.
Just finally, is this turning into a sort of culture war issue that actually, far from furthering the cause of the Indigenous people, by pitching them against other people who probably may not have given it a lot of thought before, you actually might end up setting back their cause by creating a sort of angry debate about it?
You've absolutely hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what is unfolding across Australia now. Now, no referendum gets up unless traditionally, it has the support of both the big political parties, the Liberal and the Labor Party. Now, the Liberal and the Nationals, who form the coalition opposition, they were in government until the change of government to Labor a couple of years ago. They oppose this. So that's hurdle number one, let alone the other actual thresholds we just talked about in constitutional change being approved. And so now what we're seeing take place is a huge argument between the right and left, although you do have to be very careful. There's a lot of left-wing supporters who also do not support an Indigenous voice. People who would have voted for the change in government, for example, will vote no against this, and for a variety of reasons. And so, yes, you are seeing this take a political front stage. The opposition leader has actually called on the Prime Minister to can this referendum right now, saying that it should only go to the people when they have consensus. Because of the caution Australians exercise in changing the constitution, usually it is the case that you really do have to build a huge public consensus with both sides of Parliament behind it before you take it to the people. Now, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is saying no way. He still wants to go ahead with this vote on October 14. But I think, Matt, if we have a discussion say, October 15 and the voice did not get up, a lot of these questions you're asking will be coming out with much more political force from the left as well.
We'll be fascinated to see what happens. We'll keep an eye on that. Was it October the 14th? Latika Burke, really good to speak to you there from the Sydney Morning Herald, taking us through the referendum in Australia.
That's quite a bit faster than I was necessarily expecting.
That's me on a plane, flying back from Sydney to Liverpool, and then it's a short train ride, it's complicated, to Blackpool. So Blackpool, our final stop on our tour of referendums around the world. The council's holding a referendum to give community powers over any new developments in the neighbourhood of Marton Moss. Well, Stephen Woodhouse is chairman of the Marton Moss Forum. Stephen, what was it about Britain's national experience of referendums that made you think you wanted to have one locally?
Well, good morning. This was not something that we planned. This was a request that we look at having a referendum to take control of planning and other small issues in the Marton Moss area. Under the 2016 Locality Act. And the council asked us to form a committee and ask the residents of the area if this is what they wanted to do. So the committee met in 2018 and we asked the public if they would like us to try to write a neighbourhood plan.
So what you're
at the time,
yes, I go on.
Very few people knew what this involved, and I'm not sure even the council knew what was involved.
you're now having a referendum on it. Is this basically the ultimate test of NIMBYs versus YIMBYs, the people who want more development and the people who don't?
I would say very few people want more development. The question lies in the big landowners, whether they would like big estates and to cash in on the land that they own. But there are few people, most people, because this is a very strange area. It was mostly horticulture from the 1930s onwards. And people have plot sizes of around an acre to, like our plot is nearly 3 acres. Those people don't really want to have 15 houses to the acre, which is what the government would like us to build. And in order to stop having the government's policy imposed on us, we would write something that the residents want.
And so is it getting heated? Is it hotting up?
No, it's not. No, it's not. Because the reality is that Blackpool Council is pushed at all directions, staff-wise, time-wise. I'm not sure that it was ever intended that we actually produce this plan and get it to go to referendum. And they've really, although they started out very enthusiastic, their enthusiasm died very quickly. If they'd have given us a lot of help, we could have done this 2 years ago. But pandemics and other things intervened.
So go on.
We're now sort of at a stage where we've done the plan, we've asked everything. They have no choice but to do it.
So the referendum's on the 5th of October. Saying, do you want Blackpool Council to use the neighbourhood plan for Marton Moss to help it decide planning applications in the neighbourhood area?
Yeah.
What do you think will happen?
There's two things that have happened. One is we couldn't get information out of electoral services until this afternoon, which makes it very close to the actual referendum itself. So we'll go have a meeting this afternoon and we'll start our campaign. It's getting apathy. The people who have strong feelings against it will turn out.
Yeah.
The people with strong feelings for it will turn out. But really, we've got 812 voters and it's the middle people that we have to get involved. Yeah.
Well, best of luck with it, Stephen. You've got, so that's not very long at all, is it? Until the 5th of October, is it? Two or 3 weeks. Stephen, really good to speak to you. We'll keep an eye on it. We'll come back to you and see what happens at the end of it all. Stephen Woodhouse there, chairman of the Martin Moss Forum, where they're going to the polls in Martin Moss in just a couple of weeks' time. Right, well, that brings us to the end of our tour of the globe. So I'll probably do a Rishi Sunak. Just hop on a plane back from Blackpool to Times Radio Towers. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Do get in touch. You can email me, matt@times.radio, or post a review. Maybe not just about my comments about Rory Stewart, which seems to have got some of you rather agreed. Anyway, hit subscribe so you don't miss any future top quality content. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.